Chapter 43, a chapter in which we learn many important things. Christian and Big Tiger sat the whole afternoon in front of the small blue tent, and when the sun sank behind the hills, they helped Cymbeluk to feed the horses and water the camels. "Are you Mongols?" asked Cymbeluk. "Not yet," said Christian, "but we will be soon." Cymbeluk laughed. "You can manage camels already," he said approvingly. But there were only two camels, which, Cymbeluk explained, were for carrying the tents and the few things needed for a desert journey. "We ride on horses," he said proudly, "and we've got plenty of them." Besides Cymbeluk, there were only two silent elderly men who seemed rather hostile to the boys. Their occasional words sounded like the rumble of distant thunder. "Put the pot on. Fetch water. Or put that thing away," they said to Christian. The latter words referred to the pistol, which Christian had donned again. Despite the sunshine, it was a dreary afternoon. Tolis lay sleeping in the tent. Moonlight had gone to Dampignac for orders and only came back in time for supper. The men sat round the fire, and from the open door one could see into the vast night landscape. "A new moon," said one of the men. "How many more are to pass?" asked another, petulantly. "Now, Yuchi," replied Moonlight, "don't meddle in matters which are for the prince to decide." "We want to see him made king at last," said Yuchi. "On the eve of the Battle of Kobdo, he promised us we would. That's a long time ago." "In those days," Moonlight recalled, "we were in league with many princes who today are against us. Why does he not force them to acknowledge him?" cried Yuchi. "He's more powerful than they all, and he's a Koshut." "Be quiet," commanded Moonlight. "This has lasted for years, so what do a few more days matter?" "A few more days?" asked Yuchi distrustfully. "We are leaving the castle before the moon is full," said Moonlight. "The time is near." "Yabona!" cried Cymbeluk joyfully. "Hush," said Moonlight. "You know what has to happen before then." "That old story," growled Yuchi. "I won't tolerate such talk," said Moonlight sternly. "Look at Tolis. He's been made a cripple, and something still worse befell the prince." "When shall we set out?" asked Tolis. "The prince's orders are that we set out before sunrise," answered Moonlight. "Cymbeluk shall ride to Tsagan Burgatum to await good fortune and affliction. Yuchi and Sanyen Bayer are to pack up the tents and follow with the camels and horses. You, Tolis, are to ride with them and wait in the castle until good fortune arrives." "Never!" said Tolis beside himself. "It can't be otherwise," said Moonlight. "It must be otherwise," shouted Tolis. "No, it cannot," said Moonlight. The eyes of Tolis filled with angry tears. "Shong Ma will escape you," he wailed. "You have never been able to catch him. You've always caught the wrong man. Only I can recognize him. I'll seize him, and I won't let him go. I must be there." "It can't be," said Moonlight again. At this point, Tolis resorted to pleading. "You know, Moonlight," he said, "that I seek no gain. I seek only vengeance. For years I've been sitting alone in the silent desert. If you go without me, you'll get into trouble." Tolis had been too long alone and had spent too many nights with fierce thoughts of vengeance to be able to relinquish them now. They grew pale in the daytime while he tended the sheep or hoed the poppy field, but as soon as darkness fell, they were with him again. They crouched beside him at the fire and went to bed with him on the Kong. They never left him. "He's right," said the rebellious Yuchi. "You must take him with you." At this, Moonlight stood up with a growl and went over with Tolis to the venerable chief. Yuchi closed the tent and lay down to sleep with the silent Sanyen Bayer. Young Cymbeluk sat at the fire and shook his head. "If he has his way, it will be the first time the prince's wishes are set aside," he said. "Shut up," cried Yuchi fiercely. But at that moment, Moonlight came back, followed by Tolis, who was pale and bowed down with disappointment. Nobody said another word. The fire went out, and Pig Tiger lay down beside Christian. "Oh, Kwee Chan," whispered Big Tiger, "do you understand what that means?"
"It can't be helped," whispered Christian.
"What does your grandfather say to it?"
"He says the cry for vengeance is like the crow of a cock. It tries to reach to heaven, but it can't."
"And we're to be there," whispered Christian unhappily. "We'll have to stick it out.
You're as brave as the old men of the mountain. I admire you."
It was a calm and glorious night. The stars pursued their silent courses. Everyone except Tolis slept. And when Cymbeline got up and made a fire, Tolis stared into the flames with crazed eyes. He was pale and silent, and when Moonlight stood up and took his gun, he still did not stir.
"The time has come," said Moonlight to Christian and Big Tiger. "We are leaving."
"Worthy old Uncle Tolis," said Big Tiger, "we have to go, but we shall count the hours until we can rejoice in your presence again."
"We hope it will be soon," said Christian, and they both bowed deeply.
Tolis nodded, but did not look up, and they left the tent on tiptoe. Cymbeline was holding four horses ready, and then the venerable chief came. His red robe looked black, for it was still night, and the stars were twinkling coldly. The poodle ran from one to the other. He did not bark, but as Dumpignac went by, he growled softly.
"Where's Yuchi?" asked Dumpignac. "Tell him and Sanyen Bayer to come."
They both came out of the tent, and Dumpignac said,
"We heard your talk yesterday evening, Yuchi. How long have you been with us?"
"I have served you for 16 years.
"Hand your gun to Sanyen Bayer, take a camel and your share of meat, and leave us. We do not wish ever to see you again, Yuchi."
"It would not be good for you," added Moonlight. Yuchi remained silent, and so did Sanyen Bayer. As the venerable chief mounted, they saluted him with a kowtow. Moonlight then mounted, and after him Christian and Big Tiger. Their saddlebags hung behind them, and their sheepskins were folded double on the saddles as before. Nothing had been forgotten. Only the horses were different ones. They were somewhat bigger, and they tossed their heads, but none of them got excited, even when Christian mounted.
Cymbeline cried, "Se Yabona," but it was a joyless farewell.
The venerable chief rode ahead. Moonlight began to sing, and Christian and Big Tiger recognized the tune.
"The old Marin also sang the song about Chusera to us," said Christian when Moonlight finished.
"I wish the old Marin was here," sighed Moonlight. "He's a clever old man, and he has the prince's ear because he's his friend."
"Is there something wrong?" asked Big Tiger.
"Can it be spoken of?" asked Christian.
"Yuchi spoke of it," replied Moonlight. "Didn't you hear him?"
"It seems a difficult matter," said Big Tiger. "It was not the right time to speak."
"The prince is harsh in his judgments," said Christian.
"No, he's lenient," said Moonlight. "When a servant rebels, the reasons are many and deep. Yuchi was not bad, but now he will become bad, for he lacks patience, and patience is the first virtue which a robber needs. A robber without patience should have his head chopped off."
"Does a robber need virtues?" asked Christian, surprised.
"He needs them more than other people," explained Moonlight. "He will never be a great robber unless he knows where something is to be gotten. That's his instinct. He must be the first in a fight. That's his courage. He must be the last to retreat. That's his sense of duty. He must share the booty justly. That's his goodness. But the most difficult requirement in a robber is that he should never attempt the impossible. That is his wisdom. I do wish we still had the old Marin with us."
"Was he with you once?" asked Christian.
"You are asking a question which must not be answered," replied Moonlight.
"But we're not traitors," said Christian.
"Nor are we inquisitive," said Big Tiger proudly.
"Forgive me," said Moonlight, "but you know, a robber's life is a dangerous one. The old Marin was not a Redbeard, but he was with us in the castle for 2 years. During that time, he only went out at night, and so nobody ever saw him in our company, and therefore he has been able to live peacefully on the Etzin Gol. It was through him we first got word that an army was coming to besiege us, and he watched the treasure of Etzina, of which he and I alone know anything. It is true, of course, that only the prince knows the place where the gold and jewels lie buried, and could find the great treasure. So you see the richest man in the world riding out there ahead of you. The sun rose, its rays wakened the blue of the heavens, and the earth became yellow like the day before, when Christian had to ride by the compass. Dampignac's red robe floated in the breeze like a flag. The richest man in the world, thought Christian, and it all seemed very uncanny. The treasure of Etzina, said Moonlight, is his rightful heritage, for Dampignac is a Kossuth, a direct descendant of Arap Tan. They rode on the whole afternoon. Dampignac never looked round. He needed no compass. In the south lay dunes, and Dampignac rode round them. The route led through chains of hills, and he led the way without hesitation into one of 100 valleys, all of which looked exactly alike. They didn't meet a single cairn or oboe, for there were no travelers to need a landmark. Mortals had no business whatever there. But whenever Christian peeped at his compass, it always pointed the same way. They were riding southwestward without the slightest deviation. The heading was 135 degrees, Christian noted. They halted at midday, and Moonlight hobbled the horses. Dampignac sat down 10 paces away. He closed his eyes, and the beads of his chaplet began to glide through his fingers. He looked almost as if he were asleep, but his lips moved slightly. His thumb pushed the next bead forward, and one could see that he was awake and praying. Christian and Big Tiger took down their saddlebags, and the poodle watched them expectantly. His tongue was trembling in his open mouth, and he was panting hard. "There's no water here," said Big Tiger. They sat down beside Moonlight and opened their bag. "I'm not in the habit of eating on a journey," said Moonlight, but he took a cake of wheat bread out of politeness. They themselves shared one between them. When they opened the bag again to get some meat for the poodle, they found Tolis's copper water flask in it. "Tolis is kind beyond measure," said Moonlight. "I know that well. I'm very sorry he had to stay behind." "May we ask the reason?" said Big Tiger. "The reason is simple," said Moonlight. "His hate is so boundless that it would make him rash. We can't risk having such people with us on our undertakings. For that reason, only 4 of us are riding to Ming Shui. And if we meet Shong Ma, even the prince will stay behind until we've got what we've been searching for 20 years. "Ene ye beno?" asked Christian. "We're looking for the prince's family jewels," said Moonlight in a low voice. "Since Shong Ma offered to sell 2 hair clasps to poor Tolis, we've heard nothing more of the treasure. The hair ornaments of the princess alone were worth 5,000 horses, but it's not for that reason we're looking for them." "We understand," said Big Tiger, "but where would Shong Ma have the jewels?" "Tinger Metne," said Moonlight. "Heaven only knows." Christian took his courage in both hands. "And what then?" he asked. "Then Shong Ma must die," said Moonlight. "He won't escape this time." Christian turned pale. He knew that was the only answer, but hearing it spoken instead of just thinking it made a frightful difference. When Good Fortune had shouted, "I'll shoot Greencoat dead," it was quite certain that he wouldn't do so. It was only necessary to plead with him and pretend to think him a terrible war god, and all was well again, for Good Fortune was a human being like themselves. But Dampignac was a pitiless avenger. Christian looked at Big Tiger, but Big Tiger was hanging his head. Without raising it, he said, "Worthy Mr. Moonlight, we'd rather not ride to Ming Shui." "But don't you want to get your truck back?" Moonlight reminded him. "We'd like to," Christian admitted, "and we know now that this Greencoat, or Shong Ma, is a very wicked man. But we've betrayed him, and that's wicked, too." The house of the wicked collapses without mortal help, replied Moonlight. When I got back to the castle with Thunderbolt, the prince already knew that Greencoat was Shong Bao, so you didn't betray him. But how did he come to know? Well, he came to know because it had to come out at last, and because we've got friends. You know that we went to war with the governor of Kansu, and he lost the war. He is our neighbor in the south. But to the west lies Xinjiang, and the old governor in Urumqi is our friend. Is that Marshal Yang Zhengxin? Inquired Christian. Yes, that's he, said Moonlight, and he's friendly to us because we guard the trade routes. The caravans can travel in safety, and trade is flourishing. Therefore, Marshal Yang's frontier guards often do us a good turn, and when we meet them at Ming Shui, we get all the news. They told us that the great merchant Greencoat had requested an audience of the old governor 3 months ago on the subject of the robber Dampignac. The prince thereupon resolved to keep an eye out for this gentleman. We soon found out that Greencoat had a branch office at Tsing Tsing Ha and that his caravans were traveling only by the Silk Road. Since then, our people have been roaming southward as far as the Silk Road. From time to time, we cut the telegraph wires, so the mail people had to send a messenger with the telegrams to the next station until the wire was mended. We caught this messenger and just took the written telegrams from him. But first, we allowed him to copy them so that the old governor would not be annoyed with us and trade would not suffer. A horseman brought these telegrams quickly to the castle, and the prince read them, but only two of them seemed to him to be important. The first one came nearly a month ago and was addressed to Governor Yang in Urumqi, but I don't know exactly what was in it, as I was still with the king of the Sunnites at that time. "Little paw!" cried Dampignac admonishingly. He stood up and came toward them slowly. Moonlight grinned, embarrassed. "You should not tell a lie," said Dampignac seriously. Moonlight defended himself. "I know only half or less," he said. "I was not there." Dampignac sat down between Big Tiger and Christian. The first lightning letter ran, "To His Excellency Yang Zhengxin, Marshal of China, Tiwa Fu, sending Compass Mountain and Big Tiger to you today. Arrive about 10 days, Wu Pei Fu." That lightning letter came from Cui La Xian, said Dampignac, smiling. But his smile lasted only a moment. Then he continued, as if he hadn't seen the frightened look on Christian's face and Big Tiger's wink. Probably he didn't see either how Christian grasped his breast pocket, for he was looking straight ahead. "At that time," continued Dampignac, "I didn't know who Compass Mountain and Big Tiger were, but now I do." Paused again, as if he were waiting for one of them to say something, but Christian did not stir, and Big Tiger remained silent. They waited anxiously to see if Dampignac would touch on the secret of the sealed letter, or whether the danger would pass over. "The second lightning letter, which I intercepted," continued Dampignac, "read, 'To Li Wan Pei, Hami, send 40 cans of gasoline to Tsing Tsing Ha, urgent, Shong Ma.' An hour later, I set out for the Etsin Gol. I rode day and night, for I hoped to catch Shong Ma. The telegram came from Ashan, and I thought he would come by the southern road, past the Black City. I looked up the old Marin, who told me about Greencoat. Thus I learned what I did not know. But I arrived too late. Instead of Shong Ma, I saw you, and now I know all." "Now we understand what was not clear," said Christian. "We thank you for your esteemed confidence," said Big Tiger. "Give your dog a drink," said Dampignac. "We have to set out, for you're 20 days behind. The old governor in Urumqi will be anxiously watching out for you." Christian picked up the water bottle, and Big Tiger went to get an eating bowl, for there was nothing else for the dog to drink out of. They were so busily occupied that they did not see how the venerable chief smiled meaningly at Moonlight, and how Moonlight, grinning broadly, tapped his chest on the spot where he thought General Wu's letter was reposing on Christian's breast. Yabona, cried Dampignac, hanging his prayer chaplet round his neck and going to his horse. Moonlight was already there, holding the horses, and they all mounted. They moved south toward a mountain range which arose from the stony plain. There was sand, too, but it lay no higher than a hand's breadth. One could feel the hard ground beneath, and the poodle trotted along contentedly when the horses slowed down to a walk. But as soon as the sand ended, the horses began to trot, and seemed to want to make up for lost time. The mountains were not high. One of the many peaks was crowned by an oboe, and Dampignac was obviously steering his course by this. Shortly before the ascent began, they met a caravan track which led from the north, and Christian took out the map. The party were riding side by side with slack reins. "Show me your map," said Dampignac. He looked at it for a long time and then gave it back. "Where are we now?" he asked. "I can't read that writing." "It's English," said Christian. "I believe we're coming into the mountains called Boro Ola now." "We're already in them," said Dampignac. "The hidden well is also in the Boro Olo Mountains." "Then," said Christian, "this is the caravan road which leads to Suchau." "Good," said Dampignac. "But what's written here?" And he pointed to the little crossed hammers. "The words Old Gold Region are written near the hammers, and I really don't know." "Quite right," Dampignac interrupted him. "The map-makers know more than the traders who pass the way, water their camels at the well, and have no idea that gold was once dug there." "Is there a well there, too?" asked Christian. "Only recently," said Dampignac. "It was sanded up, but I got it cleaned out. That's why the people across the seas don't know about it yet. You can tell them when you get back." "I'll remember that," promised Christian. A while later, they reached the pass. It had been a short ascent, and the valley was wide. Toward the other side, it dropped off steeply, and as it ran straight, the view was unimpeded. The world had never seemed so big. One could see to its quivering edge, but it was a world all yellow and dead. No rain or snow fell here, or if perchance it did, it was dried up and gone the next day. In the spring, the monsoon swept over it, but it carried the clouds away far above, and the thunder resounded from futile lightnings which struck angrily upon the sand. Where on earth the water for the well came from was a puzzle. But it was certainly there, and as the riders trotted down the mountainside, the poodle ran on ahead. At the foot of the last hill, which was scarcely a hill at all, he stopped and whimpered with joy. He was impatient for Moonlight to lift the planks and remove the sacking from the well hole. The shaft was lined with willow rods, and one could see to the bottom. Christian and Big Tiger looked down, and each knew that the other was thinking of Bator and his story of the well, which nowhere at all had dug with such toil at White Stone. When they had watered the horses, and the poodle lay peacefully blinking at the sun, Christian told the story of the well at White Stone, and the venerable chief listened attentively. "Nowhere at all was a strange man," he said. "He spoke to the beasts and the stones, and they all answered him gladly. He wouldn't have stopped here for one moment, and he hit the ground with his whip." Christian and Big Tiger did not venture to ask why not, but it was unnecessary, for Dampignac continued. "The treasure of Etsina came out of these mountains, my children. All the gold which the Kossuth Mongols possessed was dug here. A devil found it, and Araptan took it because he wanted to become powerful as Dagon. He assembled warriors, but they were too few, and he heaped up gold, but it was too much. When he needed workmen, he invaded the provinces of the emperor and depopulated whole villages. They lie here, buried under the stones. The emperor warned Araptan, but he warned him as a brother warns brother, with mild reproof. For the emperor was well pleased with Araptan for heaping up so much gold for him and taking upon himself a blood guilt which offered the emperor a welcome excuse for war. When Araptan began to win the Mongol princes with gifts, and when his warriors became numerous, the emperor, who was cunning, knew it was time to check him. He thought he would carry away the treasure of Etsina as a strong thief takes a chest on his shoulders and runs. But his soldiers stormed a burning city and found ruins and rubble instead of gold. It was here, and again he tapped the ground, that Araptan's downfall began, and it is an ill-omened place. Let us ride on. And he stood up. Moonlight covered the well, and Christian and Big Tiger helped him. They looked around for any sign of an old shaft or mine hole, but the hills and the mountains seemed as untouched and unchanged as at the beginning of the world, and the caravan road ran straight up through the broad valley. It led from Suchau to Barkul, and none of those who passed thought or knew of the gold so near them. Only the mapmakers in Europe knew about it, and for the first time Christian looked at his western sheet with a shudder of awe at the thought of so much secret tradition. From now onward the way led southwest again. The great plain rose and sank, but the difference in level was scarcely noticeable, so gradual was it, and so measureless the space. When the first foothills from the west obstructed the view, Dampignac turned round and, pointing ahead, said, "Another hour!" They were already 2 hours in the saddle. The poodle was trotting along, panting, and the sun had long since shown the approach of evening. Soon after, they saw a caravan track that ran parallel with the route they were following. "This is the road to Hami," said the venerable chief, as Christian got out the map. "Ma rode along here," said Moonlight, pointing to the fresh camel tracks, "so he's in front of us." The mountain ridge to the south came no nearer. In fact, it receded. The terrain grew more level, and in the end looked like sea waves when the sun plays on the water. And it went on and on like that. The hour Dampignac mentioned had long since passed. It must have been a Mongolian hour, which means that it was as long as two others. When it had passed, the waves in the sea of sand ended too. Suddenly, a gray expanse of gravel lay before them, as flat as the bed of a stream or as the glacis around a fortress. In the middle were three hills. They were not high or in any way remarkable. On the middle one, which was the largest, stood a fortress surrounded by walls of hewn stone. It consisted of square buildings and a watchtower with windows opening on all sides. One could see the sentry from far away. A bugle call resounded through the clear air. It was still bright day, and the sun stood high over the horizon, but evening was falling rapidly. The shadow of the watchtower lay over the flat roofs of the nearby buildings. Then it fell over a wall of the inner courtyard into the interior. The horses slowed down to a walk. One could hear the poodle panting alongside, and a rider galloped out of the gateway in a cloud of dust, slapping his horse with his boots on breast and belly, his yellow cloak flapping in the wind, while still a long way off he roared, "Oh, my young brothers, my heart is full of joy!" Dampignac turned to Christian and Big Tiger with a smile. "I didn't know you were related to Thunderbolt," he said. "It turned out that way in the course of time," said Big Tiger. "It is an honor for us," said Christian.